Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Monday, August the 22nd. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Kenya, where he will meet leaders from eight African nations to discuss regional security. What are Kenyans expecting from this trip?
It's a plus since Americans are well equipped in terms of fighting terrorism. So when we work together with them, I think we benefit.
And the whereabouts of Riek Machar, South Sudan's former vice president, are still unknown. The DRC's government spokesman denies that he is in Kinshasa.
What we heard is rumors that he is in the border near the Democratic Republic of Congo, but not within the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
In Nairobi later today, visiting US Secretary of State John Kerry is expected to hold talks with leaders from eight African nations, including his host, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Their agenda is counter-terrorism. The importance of beefing up regional security was underlined on Sunday when suicide bombers killed at least 17 people in Puntland in neighbouring Somalia. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the blasts. The group has been blamed for attacks on Kenya in the past. DW's Andrew Wasiki reports.
A year after the visit by US President Barack Obama to Kenya, US Secretary of State John Kerry touched down in the country on Sunday and will today pay a courtesy call on President Kenyatta at State House in Nairobi. The U.S. Embassy in Nairobi says that during his trip to Kenya, Kerry will meet with President Kenyatta to discuss regional security issues and counter-terror cooperation, as well as Kenya's 2017 elections. The meetings in Nairobi on security issues will not only revolve around Kenya, but the East African region, including Burundi, South Sudan and Somalia, as State House spokesman Manoah Esipisu confirms.
Primarily, discussions between the President and the Secretary will center around regional security and stability. Specific issues likely to be discussed will include stabilizing our northern neighbor, South Sudan. Secretary Kerry is also likely to inquire about developments in Somalia and Burundi.
Human Rights Watch has called on John Kerry to push President Uhuru to pledge to end human rights violations, extrajudicial killings and injustices in Kenya. In the streets of Nairobi, Kenyans from different walks of life had various expectations regarding Kerry's visit to Kenya. Let's listen to some of their voices.
The coming in of John Kerry in Kenya, to me, is not something that Kenyans should be happy about. Whenever Americans visit or try to be friendly with the country, then it always end up in a disaster. They are always after something, especially I know they have heard about the oil, and most probably they are after that. There's nothing good that America is coming here.
Even if he comes or not, Kenya remains the same. There is no anything in developing, like development in terms of trade or any like combating terrorism and everything. It will remain the same thing, no development.
It's a plus since Americans are well equipped in terms of fighting terrorism. So when we work together with them, I think we benefit.
If John Kerry will be coming and then he will tell Kenyans, America will be ready to assist, to ensure a free and fair election, and we have a good president, then we shall be happy. So unless John Kerry is coming to stress the importance of free and fair elections, not somebody coming and then just wishing away some things.
Kenyans airing their views on the visit to Nairobi by US Secretary of State John Kerry, ending that report by Andrew Wasiki. For analysis of this visit, my colleague Isaac Mugabe has been talking to Uganda-based journalist Angelo Isama about what the Secretary of State is hoping to accomplish in Kenya and in Nigeria, the second leg of his tour. He began by asking him what he thought about the timing and agenda of the visit.
Firstly, I think that terrorism has once again taken center stage, not just only in US's current presidential campaign, but also because of the attacks in Europe. I think there's renewed effort to make sure that they soft state where, you know, terrorism breeds much faster and then migrates to the West are handled. Now, the Secretary's visit is in the two areas where this is most urgent. First is Nigeria with Boko Haram. Secondly is East Africa and Kenya in particular with Al-Shabaab. I think that represents how serious the U.S. establishment considers the question of long-term responses to international terrorism by trying to contain it in their home areas.
Don't you think it's high time African leaders took pride in dealing with their own issues rather than someone else preaching to them what they ought to do or not do?
Well, I don't think that there is an inconsistency in the partnership between Western leaders and African leaders. I think that the narrative was stronger in, you say, 20 years ago when such a visit would have been seen as, you know, essentially representing U.S. foreign policy. And the foreign policy establishment generally considers the definition of the term as what the West does to other nations. But today, in this area of increasing globalization, I think all hands on deck are necessary. Some of the problems that we are facing here in East Africa, for example, widespread unemployment, the rise of radicalization of young people who form the biggest part of the population, are aggravated by immigration and migration and immediately become global problems. So I don't see the visit necessarily as the West carrying it an unfair share of the load. I think it's just necessary in today's multipolar world that everyone does their bit.
Angelo Isama, political analyst and journalist in Uganda.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
South Sudan's new first vice president, Taban Dengai, is on a two-day visit to Khartoum for talks with Sudanese leaders on thorny issues still outstanding since South Sudanese independence in 2011. The whereabouts of Deng's predecessor, Riek Machar, remain unclear as the South struggles to emerge from more than 2.5 years of civil war. My colleague Eunice Wanjiru asked James Shimanyula for more information about the precarious condition of the world's youngest nation.
South Sudan is relatively calm, but the situation remains relatively, if I can use that word, volatile, given that there is still reported fighting of forces loyal to the two leaders, Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, the president, but not inside Juba, outside Juba, for the control of certain strategic areas. Riek Machar remains in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and this has been confirmed by the United Nations spokesman, Furhan Haq, who actually supervised the airlifting of the former vice president, as you can hear him speaking now.
The UN mission contacted the authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo, who in turn requested MONUSCO to facilitate his extraction and his transfer to the care of the DRC. We have undergone an extraction operation, and so Riek Machar is currently in the care of the authorities in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
But the Congolese government in Kinshasa, through it's a spokesperson who is also Minister for Information, that is Lamba Mendo Malanga, denies that Riek Machar is there.
What we heard is rumors that he is in the border near the Democratic Republic of Congo, but not within the Democratic Republic of Congo. So nobody asked for him a request for entering the DRC. We are not aware that he is in Congo or he has requested to come in Congo.
What does the vanishing of former rebel leader Riek Machar mean to South Sudan? Could this spark new ethnic violence?
His absence in Juba means that the government that replaced him with his former comrade in arms, Taban Dengai, and a very close advisor of Riek Machar, it means that People are still hoping that Machar will come back or will go back to South Sudan. The other point is that it doesn't actually mean fighting, because fighting has been there anyway. As I said at the outset, the fighting is centered on who controls certain strategic areas on both sides of the divide, that is Salva Kiir's and Riek Machar's forces.
James Shimanyula. Senegal is a country plagued by erratic rainfall, food shortages and high unemployment. With half of the country's population under the age of 20, many people are forced to leave rural areas in search of employment. But one farming school in the region of Fimla, south of Dakar, is trying to reverse this trend. It is encouraging young people back onto the fields to ensure the existence of future generations of farmers. Emmanuel Lande reports.
With the radio on and the breeze blowing through the trees, drops splash from the bucket as it's hauled out of the well and the water is poured into waiting watering cans. Like a well-oiled machine, the male students each pick up their containers in turn and start on their morning routine, shuffling between rows of leafy green cabbages, swinging the watering cans with outstretched arms. Abdelaziz Kanare's plot is a work in progress. He's been growing cabbages, papayas and even coconut trees since January when he enrolled at Kedara Farming School. The curriculum, crop diversity and agroecology, or learning to farm holistically without pesticides which pollute the ground and the environment. Senegal's rain-fed agriculture means farmers grow crops dependent on seasonal rainfall, which is becoming more erratic with climate change. Learning to grow a diversity of crops means they'll have more revenue spread out over the year and reduce their risk of crop failure. Farming this way and without chemical pesticides will help the poor quality soil regenerate nutrients as well.
Here we cultivate in the dry season as well as the rainy season. At home in my village near Sambadia, we are farmers. We only cultivate in the rainy season. We grow millet, sorghum, peanuts, but only when it rains. Here we grow organic, and it really motivated me because in my village we use pesticides and fertilizers. Here it's organic. It's good because each year, how many people are dying because of their food, the animals they eat. To change this, we need to change our farming methods.
Students only have to fulfill one criterion to join the farming school. They have to have access to a hectare of land ready and waiting for them once they leave. Awa Diara is 25. Her father called her back from Dakar, where she was working as a housemaid, to enroll in the farm school. She jumped at the opportunity.
We have a great responsibility because it is us, the young people, who must group together and return to the fields and farm again, because agriculture is dormant now, since all the young people have left the agricultural trade. But to avoid this, we need to return to the field to show that we are the daughters of farmers.
The produce from Kedara is yet to receive any kind of organic certification. However, with the backing of the FAO, a new crop of students is due to start at the farm school after the summer. Even without the label, the graduate farmers are respecting the environment and in the long term helping to ensure food security for their communities all year round.
Emmanuel Lande reporting from Senegal. Radio drama coming up now as we join the Learning by Ear team.
Deutsche Welle, learning by ear. Listen up, shape your future.
Hello there, and welcome once again to Learning by Ear. This is the 11th episode of our ongoing radio drama, The Promised Land, a story of African migration to Europe. In the past 10 episodes, we've been following the lives of three young people, Farahani, Chivasi, and Linda, as they struggled with the issue of migration to Europe. In the previous episode, Linda surprised her parents and friends by arriving home unannounced and treated her friends to an all-night party. Meanwhile, Farahani finally managed to sneak himself onto a boat with other migrants, but when they got within sight of the shore, the man that paid to smuggle them in told them all they had to swim the last few kilometers. Many people drowned in the stormy sea, but Farahani was lucky. He was rescued at the last minute by guards with the European border agency, Frontex. So has he finally made it? What will happen to him now? And how is Chivasi taking Linda's return to Europe? Keep listening to today's episode to find out. It's called Detention Center, which is where Farahani and the other illegal migrants who survived the crossing have been taken.
You there. You go inside. And you, yes, you. This is where you'll be kept for now. When we've processed you, you'll be given a document allowing you to stay here for 30 days. After that, you'll most likely be deported back to your home country.
What? No. No, this must be a mistake. This place looks like a prison. Yes. I mean, it's cold. We are surrounded by a barbed wire fence. And how are four of us supposed to fit in this one little room?
Did you think you'd be taken to a five-star hotel? Listen, you all came here illegally. You should be glad that you have a roof over your heads at all. Until we identify your nationalities, this will be your home. Get used to it.
I want asylum. That's all. I'm from a war zone in the Middle East. How long will it take for me to be granted asylum?
Who knows? 1 month? Two, three, a year, or even 10 years. You wanted to come to Europe? Well, this is Europe. Breakfast is served at 7 in the morning, lunch at 1 p.m., and dinner at 6:30 in the evening. What? If you're late, you'll miss it. Do not try to escape from this center. We are watching your every move on camera. Any other questions? Good. Close that door.
This can't be right. It can't be. This is not what I imagined at all.
Farahani can't believe what he's seeing and hearing. What will he decide to do? Will he be able to persuade the authorities with his application for asylum? We'll soon find out. Meanwhile, Linda has left her country of origin to go back to her life in Europe. Her short visit and her apparent success over there have made all her friends desperate to go to Europe so that they can have a life like hers. But what kind of life is it, really? Let's follow Linda as she meets her friend Florence and Charles, the stranger she married to get a work permit, at Charles's house.
That's it, Florence. I can't do this anymore. That's it.
Charles, we've been through this many times. You don't have to worry. Everything will be fine.
No, it won't. Not this time. You weren't here when they came. I'm so stupid.
I'm sorry. I just got back from my homeland and I'm a bit confused. What's going on here? What's the problem?
You are the problem. You shouldn't have left.
Excuse me? I thought our marriage was I thought I was free to do as I wished. Wasn't that the agreement, Flo?
Yes, yes. But Linda, Charles is only worried because while you were away, the immigration officials came round and announced. They wanted to know why you'd gone back to your country without taking your husband along.
Oh no, oh my goodness. What happened? What did they want? Have they found out?
They suspect us. They told me that they'd caught several couples who had faked a marriage to help a foreigner stay and work in Europe. They want us to go for an interview.
Another one? Florence, what do I do? I can't afford to be sent back home. I really can't.
Hey, relax, both of you. This is what they always do. They want you to panic so that you'll make mistakes during the interview. Just act cool and confident. Linda, you'll have to lie to them and say that there was a family emergency back home.
Excuse me, I have to take this in private.
No, Linda, no. We're talking about a serious issue. You will take the call right here and make it quick.
Hello, Mom? I arrived safely. I already sent you a text. Didn't you get it?
Oh, Linda, it's...
Mom, what's going on? Are you all right?
It's your father. He was hit by a car.
What? No, that can't be. How is he, Mom? Is he okay? Please tell me he's okay.
He's in intensive care. The doctors have said it's too early to say whether or not he'll make it. Linda? Hello? Are you still there?
The lie that Linda was supposed to tell the immigration people that she'd gone home without Charles because of a family emergency has just come true. When she heard that her father was seriously ill in hospital, Linda was so shocked that she passed out. Charles and Florence were just in time to catch her and lay her on the couch. What will happen now? Meanwhile, Chivasi is desperately missing Linda. His application for a European tourist visa has been denied because he doesn't have enough money in the bank. So he decides to keep his promise.
He's going to cross the ocean to be with the girl he loves. Chivasi takes leave of absence from his job and catches a bus heading north. After traveling for several days, he reaches the North African coast and meets the same human trafficker who smuggled Farahani into Europe. Let's listen on.
Hey. Hello. You're not from here, are you?
No. It's my first time in this country.
So, what brings you here? Are you a tourist? You know, it's not safe here anymore, with all the riots and political protests.
I know, but my country isn't any better.
Aha. So, I'm guessing you might be looking for a ride?
A ride? I don't get you. What ride?
Are you trying to get to Europe?
Yes. Can you help me?
You're talking to exactly the right person. And you are a very, very lucky man. Today, a cargo ship arrived from Europe, bringing aid for refugees. A friend of mine works on it, and he says there's space for just 5 people on board for the return journey. You're the last one.
How much would I have to pay?
2,000 euros. It's a good price. Think, it's a fantastic opportunity.
2,000 euros? This is more than the return air ticket.
So go by plane if you can. You want this or not? I have a lot of work to do, my friend.
Okay. I have the money. Here.
Hey, no. Not here. You give me the money in a safe place. Come, follow me.
Chivasi follows the human trafficker to a secret location where he's prepared for the coming journey. He pays the transportation fee and is taken out alongside the ship in a little fishing boat before being snuck aboard. There, he and the 4 other migrants are hidden inside empty wooden crates. A few hours later, he hears the ship's horn signaling that it's about to depart. And soon Chivasi is on his way to Europe. Farahani, meanwhile, is already there, but he's getting increasingly frustrated, stuck in the prison-like detention center. That evening, over supper, he feels he just has to do something.
Listen, my fellow brothers and sisters. Thank you. I don't know how many of you can understand me, since we all come from different countries. But it doesn't matter, I have to try. What matters is that we are all here together, facing the same difficulties. We've been here for a whole week now, and nobody has told us anything at all about what's going on or what's going to happen to us. I know we came here illegally, but we are not criminals. So why have they caged us here like animals and abandoned us? We are all human beings. All we want is to live in peace. I say we should all go on a hunger strike. Until our cases are heard and we are given asylum, we will eat no food and drink nothing but water. How many of you are with me?
With wild cheers and applause in the detention center canteen, we've reached the end of the 11th episode of our radio drama series, The Promised Land, a story of African migration to Europe. We hope you'll join in the discussion about European detention centers for illegal migrants. You can share your views and stories on our Facebook page, facebook.com/DW.LBE. Until next time, goodbye and take care.
And back here on Africa Link, a reminder of our main story. US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Africa for talks in Kenya and Nigeria on countering terrorism. And a final item of Olympic news as the Summer Games wound down in Rio de Janeiro. Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya picked up gold in the men's marathon. We welcome your comments on our programme either via SMS to country code 49 60957 595 10, via email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or by letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. For more stories, do visit our website, dw.com/Africa. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.